This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon is a company that has innovated underwear. They use a naturally antimicrobial fabric, which eliminates odor. The design is super comfortable. Their boxer briefs, they designed it in a way where it doesn't bunch up. The legs don't bunch up your leg. So you don't have to keep on adjusting it. And if you don't like the pair, it doesn't fit you well, you can ask for a refund. No question asked. Besides underwear, they also have socks, undershirts as well. If you want to check them out, go to mackweldon.com and get 20% off using promo code AOM. Again, that's mackweldon.com, promo code AOM for 20% off. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So we've talked about Stoicism on the site. It's a philosophy born in ancient Greece, but really embraced by the ancient Romans, particularly high-class Romans like Seneca and even emperors like Marcus Aurelius, who's one of the most famous Stoic philosophers with his Meditations. But my guest today wrote a book talking about how the philosophy of Stoicism can help soldiers, men and women who are fighting in our wars, face the challenges that come with that profession. Her name is Nancy Sherman. She is a professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. She served as the chairwoman of ethics at the U.S. Naval Academy. And in her book, Stoic Warriors, she takes a look at how different facets of Stoic philosophy can help soldiers navigate things like losing a partner, losing a comrade, losing an arm, dealing with PTSD. So we talk some about that. We also discuss her most recent book, After War, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers. We discuss how not only war can traumatize someone mentally, emotionally, physically, but also morally, and what soldiers can do to heal those moral wounds, what the military is doing to do that, and what civilians can do to help the men and women who are fighting for them. Really fascinating discussion. I think you get a lot out of it. Even if you're not a soldier, the Stoic principles that we talk about, it can definitely help your own life. So without further ado, Nancy Sherman, Stoic Warriors and After War. Nancy Sherman, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
So you've written several books. We're going to talk about a few of them today. One of your books that I really enjoyed was Stoic Warriors. You look at Stoic philosophy and how it can inform the military, or how the military prepares soldiers for war, but then also deal with the aftermath of war. Before we get into the details about Stoicism's connection to the military, I would love for you to give us just a brief summary of what Stoicism is, because I think you did such a great job of it in Stoic Warriors.
Well, Stoicism is an ancient philosophy, both that the ancient Greeks after Aristotle and the Romans embraced. And it's in the tradition of ancient philosophy of being concerned about the good life and flourishing. But they take issue. And these are especially the Romans, like Seneca and Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus. They take issue with the idea that happiness should include exposure to luck, good and bad. And so they develop a philosophy of self-sufficiency and self-reliance, essentially, well before Emerson. And the idea is that your virtue alone should be sufficient for happiness. It's actually a Socratic position from way back. And so that's the idea, that cultivating your strengths and intellectual and endurance are a matter of enormous self-discipline, and that you can be, in a certain way, invincible is too strong, but protected from the outside world infringing on your projects.
Okay, so it's basically you're not letting the world or all the chaos, the things that are in flux, disrupt you emotionally, mentally. Like, it's not even an issue.
That's right. And the emotional part of not being disrupted is critical. They think that the emotions are disturbances, almost pathologies, if you like. So, and the idea, some way, is that emotions, the normal, ordinary ones of fear and of even love and anger, are ways that you are attached to the world and want the objects of those emotions. And so they leave you open to disappointment and to the inability to avert or go for the objects of the emotions. In the case of fear, adequately avert the risk. And in the case of desire, sort of get what you're going for.
Yeah.
So it's very kind of attachment free in a way, not Buddhist. It's not about quiet meditation and getting rid of the self. The self is very important, but it's just should be your reason has dominion in this world.
Yeah. And I guess they'd say a lot of the emotions are based on perception. Right. So if you can change how you view an event, so it's not the thing itself, like if your child dying, that's not the thing that's actually disturbing. It's just your perception of how you approach it is what causes the disturbance within you.
That's right. So they have this view that emotions are a sense to impressions. That's the way they put it. And a sense to ways that you're being perceived upon, you might say, as you're saying. So they're, and you can say yes or no to those assents. And you might be affected by it just sort of subliminally almost. You know, there's a great example they give. You're on a ship and you're supposed to be a sage, a great sage doctor, but yet you start turning green. And so someone turns to you and says, notice you profess to be a sage, but you're getting very seasick and scared. And the response that a Stoic will allow, well, yes, but that's just a pre-emotion or a proto-emotion. It's kind of a physiological response, and it's momentary. And the true Stoic won't indulge it. So, you know, I can sort of say no to it without it taking hold and without it really fully coming to fruition. And that, in a sense, tracks where we are in terms of our understanding of psychology. Kahneman, for example, the great Nobel Prize winning psychologist, has the notion, and many do, that we have two track systems of emotions. Those that are sort of fast track and go without much brain circuitry and very immediately responsive, and those that are more mediated. And so the Stoics had that notion early on, and they think that maybe some are a kind of arousals that you can't control, but you won't be impugned for having them. And in the long term, you can maybe control even those better than you do right now.
Yeah, and it also seemed they were very sort of foretold cognitive behavioral therapy.
To some degree,
yeah. To some degree.
That's right. Right. Because they view the emotions as not just impressions, but the part of your brain that's doing it in a sense. Well, we'll put it differently. The part of you are just reason. They're monolithic in that regard. And so you should be able to control emotions insofar as they are a sense, but a sense to that are governed by reason. And so even your perceptual capacity should be under the control of reason. So a lot of talking and a lot of suasion and persuasion should be able to change your state, what you eventually assent or do not give assent to.
Okay. And I think there's this popular conception of Stoics as just like not having any emotion whatsoever or not enjoying life. And you have to be a Stoic sage, you have to go off into a cave and cloister yourself off. But a lot of the famous Stoic thinkers, they were like Marcus Aurelius. He was an emperor and he lived a pretty good life. Seneca, he was the tutor to Nero, and he lived a pretty, he enjoyed things, he enjoyed life, probably wore nice clothes, ate good food. How does Stoicism allow for us to enjoy the good things in life? Is this where the whole things indifferent come into play?
Well, popular Stoicism, first of all, is the kind of notion, suck it up and truck on. If you're in the military or you profess a kind of Stoic, popular Stoic mentality, you are just sort of sucking it up and moving on. The Stoics were somewhat mixed about this. The Roman Stoics were, in embracing Stoicism, embracing a very widespread popular view out there. You know, it was a court, as you say, it was the court's philosophy. Seneca was the tutor to Nero, and Marcus Aurelius was the emperor who wrote the meditations, which were to himself, at night after, during the day, a huge golden statue of himself would be wheeled out and then wheeled back. So he doesn't look like too much of an ascetic when he's leading, massive legions of troops and has gold statues on his behalf. That said, he is very much trying to distance himself from those things with which he doesn't have full control. So Epictetus, who was once a slave, but then goes on to teach philosophy, in the time of Nero will say, of those things that you cannot control, say that they are indifferent to you. Now, the indifference doesn't mean, as you were sort of saying before, it doesn't mean you don't feel anything. It means that you're not attached or desirous fully of the objects of your interest, and that you can have them or not have them. In that regard, they're indifferent. You don't have an attitude of indifference, but they're not constitutive of happiness. That's what's critical. They do not add one iota to your happiness if you have things that you that you desire through the emotions, nor do they detract if you get the things that you don't want. Having them is better than not having them, but they don't add to the thing that's called happiness, flourishing, thriving.
Okay, so you can have lots of money for a moment, but if you lose the next day, you're like, meh, it's no big deal.
Yeah, and you kind of develop this notion that if my kid dies and I lose the things to which I am really attached, then I have to realize that they really weren't a part of true, genuine happiness. Now, there's going to be cognitive dissonance for most of us because you don't get to be a sage ever for most of us, and you'll still hold on to worldly goods. And by that, I don't just mean material goods. I mean the goods that many of us hold on to, love of our children whom we prize, and spouses and partners whom we adore, and whose loss would be to rip something precious out of our souls and psyches. But they still think that if you got to the highest point of perfection, you would somehow realize and embrace the idea that your goodness, if you had developed virtue, was sufficient for your flourishing.
We're going to take a quick break for your word from our sponsors. Probably something you don't think too much about when you work out are your socks, but when they don't fit right, you notice right away. It just bugs you. I hate when you get that bunched up stuff on your toe and you have to take your shoes off to adjust your socks because it's just going to bug your entire workout. Well, Bombas is a sock company that has fixed that problem. They use an Invisitoe system as a hand-leak toe seam that eliminates that annoying bump in the toe. Also, they have a honeycomb support system around the arch, so it gives you extra support when you need it most. The socks is made from Pima cotton, which is naturally antimicrobial, so it doesn't stink. And they're just really super comfortable. In fact, I'm wearing them right now, even though I've just got done from working out, and I'm doing this ad right now wearing the Bombas socks. I love them. Also, with every pair you buy, they'll donate a pair to individuals who are in need. If you want to try Bombas out, you can get 25% off your first purchase of four or more pairs by visiting bombas.com/artofman. That's bombas.com/artofman. And enjoy free shipping. Also, another podcast you guys should check out that's very similar to ours, I think you'll like it. It's called The Art of Charm, hosted by AJ and Jordan Harbinger. They interview experts from a wide variety of fields. And I talked to Jordan recently about a recent episode he did about meta learning. All right, Jordan, so you had this an interesting guest on. It was an academic. Her name is Barbara Oakley. She's an engineer. Tell us about what you guys talked about on the podcast Art of Charm.
Sure. So she's an interesting one because she came out of freaking nowhere as this learning how to learn, this meta learning expert. So at first I was very skeptical because I thought she's a professor at a small university around where I grew up that I, wasn't thinking about going to, I'll put it that way. And that was just arrogance, right? Because when I talked to her, I was like, holy cow, this woman knows how people's brains work. She's created this learning course that has 500,000 people using it or something. She's super well-respected across the world for teaching people how to learn better, meta-learning. And if you think about it, that's kind of the most powerful skill you can have, because we're all listening to stuff like your show and my show, trying to learn new things. But what if we were able to learn new things faster by learning how to learn? It's like learning inception. So we talked a lot about that, and she gave some concrete examples, as we love to do on The Art of Charm, about how to step that forward. And she gave everybody kind of access to her course as well, which is really cool.
And you can find that podcast and more at artofcharm.com, or search for them on iTunes with Art of Charm. Let's get to this connection to the military, because you're a professor of ethics. How did you get interested in seeing how Stoicism could inform military life?
Well, I was at the Naval Academy in the mid-90s in the wake of a cheating scandal, and I was asked to design a brigade-wide ethics course, which I had taught ethics for years, and so that wasn't a novel task, you might say. But on the other hand, I hadn't talked to military folks, and not just midshipmen, but officers. So I did the stuff I always do: Aristotle, Kant, Plato, and some contemporary readings. When I got to Stoicism early in the course, everyone resonated with it. In part, they resonated with it because one of their own, that is Admiral Stockdale, Jim Stockdale, had embraced Stoicism wholeheartedly. He was a graduate student way back at Stanford and kind of wandered into the philosophy department, and someone handed him a text of Epictetus, the little handbook, and he has sort of said, what do I need that for? You know, a martini-drinking aviator who plays golf, what do you need that for? So he put it aside. But then he found himself on the Ticonderoga in the middle of, on his way to Hanoi, or excuse me, on his way to Saigon, and he started reading it in the wardroom. And then one day, he's an aviator, he was shot down, and the lessons of Epictetus were sort of inscribed in his soul. And he said, I'm Jim Stockdale, leaving the world of technology and entering the world of Epictetus. And he imbibed it for himself. It was a salvation to be able to say no to the things that he wasn't in control of, because he ended up being in prison as a POW for about 7.5 years or so, two and a half in solitary with leg irons. So he found this absolutely empowering, and it helped him as the head of the chain of command, which there is in a military prison where you're POWs. So being able to say no, I control the show and not you, Cat Eye, who is the name of one of his torturers / prison guards, was critical to his survival. And so the long story is, it made sure the military knew of his story, and even if they didn't, if they were to read Epictetus, they would find it's kind of good medicine for those who are in situations of deprivation and stress.
Yeah, this is where what's called the Stockdale paradox comes from. I think he said that the way he survived was you had to be both hopeless but also have hope at the same time, which is kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
So going on to this, so in Stoic Warriors, you look at how Stoicism can inform different aspects of a soldier's life throughout their career. And you start off with talking about the body. So for a soldier, his body is important, because it's trained to be fit, to be able to do hard work, to fight. But when you're a soldier, there's a good chance that you might lose a limb or become disfigured. And that affects them. I mean, sometimes I think that affects the soldier more than losing the limb. It's just the emotional trauma that comes from being disfigured from an IUD or something like that. But the Stoics would say, like, you know, the hardcore Stoics would say, well, you know, it's your body. It's something external. You shouldn't be disturbed by that. Is there a Stoic approach to our bodies that takes into consideration the role that our body plays in our sense of self?
Well, I'm not sure they fully do. The most exaggerated case is Epictetus, who thinks of your body as just one more encumbrance, sort of like a little donkey that is you, and then you have to carry all these things that it needs. And so you've got to carry the bucket of water, and you've got to carry your food, and all of the encumbrances. And so it's a unpleasant image, and it's just being burdened down. And you're supposed to be able to distance yourself, as you say, from the physical injuries that you might suffer by realizing that the body is somehow not you, which is reason. That's a hard view to have, given in fact that you couldn't survive without a brain, and the brain is one of the body parts that it may not visibly be disfigured, but certainly you mentioned IEDs. IEDs can cause enormous rattling and traumatic brain injury, TBI, which leads to other kinds of difficulties in being in the world, having memory, having good cognitive functioning, and the like. So is there a more palatable version of Stoicism? Stoicism is kind of hard to swallow in its full form. So I would probably say not really. I've always advocated, to the degree that I find myself attracted to Stoicism, a kind of moderate Stoicism where there are blessings and curses. And I guess Seneca is the person who's always feeling the tension. He says, I'm the doctor. They call themselves doctors who heal the pathology of emotional attachment. But I'm also the patient, meaning I'm sick too. I can't fully get rid of my attachment to my body. I can't fully get rid of my grief that I lost a dear friend and that I find myself sinking in sorrow. I'm struggling too. And so he's always acknowledging the way in which the externals touch him and that he's trying to limit their impact a bit. And I guess that's one way to approach Stoicism, moderately and with some recognition that if you are trying to minimize the effect of these devastating accidents on you, that you go forth with some humility about just how much you can control in the end.
Yeah, and that's one of the things problems I've had with Stoicism is that you try to be stoic, like you make that your ideal. Like, I'm just not going to let this bother me at all, whether you lose a limb or something happens, you know, even like the daily trifles of life that just annoy you. But the problem with it is you set that as your ideal, and if you don't achieve it, then you like get angry at yourself because you feel bad about yourself that you didn't achieve that ideal, and it sort of spirals downward.
Well, that's right. I think perfectionism can be a curse, and to the degree that the Stoics set very, very perfectionist ideals, with it can come the psyche that Freud would say produces a harsh superego and anger and self-anger in the form of guilt or in the form of shame, and certainly in the form of disappointment. And so I'm not sure it's a wonderfully winning strategy. The other thing is you have to be able to acknowledge loss in order to go forward, to readjust to new body images, to be able to do the hard work that will come with physical therapy and kind of reconstitution of yourself if you've lost, as some of those I write about in After War have, full half of their body. You know, they've lost the whole bottom of their bodies, and they can't go on as they did before. And so there has to be an adjustment to loss that does involve a grieving process if you're to go forward. And I'm not sure the Stoics are the best philosophers to help us with that.
Okay. So let's talk a little about this, the anger, because it seems throughout Western history, anger has played a big role in the ethos of the warrior, right? If we go back to Homer, I mean, that's what the Iliad was all about, right? Is how anger fueled this 10-year war. And it seems like the military uses anger to an extent. Like through boot camp, you have the stereotype of the yelling drill sergeant from Full Metal Jacket and the things like that. But Stoics would say, well, no, anger is one of those emotions you shouldn't have because it's a disturbance and yada yada. So how did the Stoic philosophers approach war? If you know, other for centuries, anger was often used as a motivator for battle and for war.
That's a great question. Anger whets the appetite for war and action. It's often said. And so, what do they replace it with? Well, just to sort of be clear, anger is this disturbance pathology. Seneca rails on about it. It makes you livid, and it causes enormous havoc inside you and in the world. And part of their railing against it is because Seneca and others are advising kings who use it a lot and who go to war needlessly or throw their servants in pools of sharks and the like when they break a crystal or do something minor. So there's anger management that's required. And so that's part of their interest in being able to get rid of anger. Now, anger comes in waves. You know, some people think it is a good thing, and other people think it isn't. And anger also is of a different sort. It's not clear that you need anger in order to motivate or incite troops to battle. What you might need is, in the case of the drill sergeant, a performance of anger, just like the orator performs certain emotions, actors perform certain emotions, and they instill fear in their listeners, and that would get a young person in boot camp to move and do better if you incite the wrath of your drill sergeant. Now, it could also be that the inductee gets a real dose of anger that moves them to battle. But the problem, the Stoics will say, is that you can't shut it off easily. And so you have rampages and revenge killings and hadithas or milais or the like. So the Stoics think that you can actually fight on principle. You know, you might have a sense of what's right and wrong and a sense of justice, and that will be able to carry you forth in action. And I think it's a real live question as to how useful anger is. I mean, we wouldn't want to get rid of, many would argue, resentment, indignation, moral protest, moral outcry, if you don't have those emotional reactions to horrific world scenes of refugees or innocent victims being killed. How do you morally engage? But others would say, well, have that first proto-emotion of it, and maybe the Stoics will give you that. Have it so it kind of rouses you, but then be able to put it into or contain it and use your reason to motivate you forward after that. Use it as a transitional pivot and move on after that. And that may be a way to get the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Both light the match, but then contain it.
Yeah. And speaking of that idea that, you know, the fear of anger is that once you get it going, it's hard to turn off, particularly in warriors. I think you mentioned in your book how oftentimes when men return from war, like increases in spousal abuse happen.
Yes. I mean, it's a complicated story, and to just say, well, it's there's anger management problems is too narrow. There's all sorts of reactions to war that have to do with grief, have to do with the difficulty of civilian reintegration, resentment to civilians who don't understand, confusion about or anger about of the injustice of a war, whether it's the conduct or the cause, or too many collateral killings that were authorized or not enough because then you lose your troops. The moral mess of war is endless, and you're asking thinking soldiers to sort it through. And it's got to bubble up in frustration as well as a certain kind of difficulty in adjusting to the tempo of life afterwards. So to just sort of say it's anger and that you can't control the anger when you come home, I think understates the moral complexity of trying to adjust the emotions of war to the emotions of civilian life.
Yeah, I want to get more into the moral complexities of after war, because that's what your most recent book is called, After War. But before, you mentioned grieving. That's a problem that soldiers have. And the Stoic approach, there's a story of, I forgot who gave it, but like the king who forced a person to eat their own child. Mm-hmm. And the appropriate Stoic response was, well, that was, thank you. You know, like not be upset about it, just do it and just calmly eat it and then go away. That to me seems, doesn't seem very healthy, a very healthy approach. I guess the question would be, is there a way we can look at, use moderate Stoicism to help soldiers and civilians alike deal with the loss of loved ones?
Well, that was Cambius, who was asked to do that, I think. It's so attractive to be Stoic in some ways. And I'm one of those persons who's attracted to it. The world throws up tons of things that we can't control. The vicissitudes of fortune are around us all the time. The limits of our being able to influence our children exactly the way we want to, or our spouses exactly the way we want to, or our students, or the political process, or the army, or the navy, or the course of a country's future. We're small, and we all live in systems, and the systems collectively exert enormous amount of pressure on us, and yet we are asked to hold on to our individual consciences, and we can't always be whistleblowers, and yet we have to do good in a world that's extremely flawed with pressures that we can't manage always. So why not try to be Stoic about some of these things? Now, it doesn't mean indifferent, but it does mean know the limits of your control and try to expand the circle of your control as widely as you can without being a control freak. Because no one likes a control freak who's managing other people's lives. Or if you're too self-managing, then you yourself are letting out the experience of too many things that you can't manage, but you need to feel. So I think experimenting with the borders of control is the best way to be a mindful Stoic. You might say at the end of the day, you end up an Aristotelian.
That's really good. I think, yeah, you mentioned in the book how, some soldiers right now, the way they deal with grief is maybe they might not cry in front of their troop, but when they're in their tent with like their close buddy, that's when they'll let it out, have that moment of grief. So they're mindful of it.
Well, yes. There's always a performative element in being a leader, and especially a leader with all the modeling that comes with wearing the uniform and projection to very young troops who may be less seasoned in battle than you are. Some more seasoned officers don't always face and often don't face the same stresses that the enlisted who deploy over and over again do. So you got to be there for them, and you're sort of trying to show toughness. But if we look at the suicide rates recently, we know that the modeling doesn't always hold in your most private moments, and you can't closet off parts of yourself and hope that you will forever not see them. They come back to haunt you.
Yeah. So in your most recent book, After War, you make the case that in a lot of ways we've made clinical the emotional, mental, and moral wounds that our veterans come home with. First off, let's talk about this, the moral wounds or moral trauma, because that's something you don't hear very often when we talk about soldiers coming home from war. You hear about PTSD, traumatic brain injuries, lost limbs, but you never hear about moral trauma. How would you describe what is moral trauma?
So moral trauma or moral injury is a sense of, it's a psychological sense that you may have done wrong in a serious way, or been wronged in a serious way, or fallen from ideals that you subscribe to in a very serious way, and that you are hurting. There's anguish as a result. So it can be accompanied by reactions of enormous guilt in the case of transgression, or if you've been transgressed, resentment, or in the case of falling short, annihilating shame. And it's a psychological injury, but PTSD is typical, or PTS without the D for disorder, which some find stigmatizing, has clinically at least been understood as a fear response. You're responding to a sense of being helpless, to a threat, a life threat. And the treatment has been a kind of deconditioning of that fear and that life threat, because you're now not in a condition of threat, but yet you're reliving the stimulus as if you were. We need to recognize that all sorts of emotions that cause anguish and enormous pain come home from war, or come home from other kinds of assaults and infringements, and that they're not all fear based. And so, moral injury is a way to talk about that. Like PTSD, it can be invisible, meaning you're not coming home from the battlefield or from a trailer in Nevada, if you're a remote pilot, with a visible loss, missing something, or blinded, or without hearing, but you are coming home with a psychological injury.
And so how do we, I guess, I don't know if treat is the right word, because it sounds clinical, right? I mean, we know what we can do for physical injuries, psychological injuries. You can go to counseling. But what do you do for moral injuries? Is it?
Well, yeah, I think you still can see clinicians, mental health professionals. So I don't mean to depathologize all of the suffering that comes home from war, by no means. I mean, we're very short on mental health clinicians in the services and in the VA, and people need to be able to reach out without stigma. But we also have to realize that some of what we do in this country isn't enough, and we could do more. We say thank you for your service as a quick way of separating the war from the warrior. But it's also kind of pat and a bit superficial, and doesn't always lead to a deeper conversation that builds bridges between military and civilian. We are afraid to ask what people's war experiences were, or what people's experiences when they didn't deploy but are sitting doing war-related work on bases at home, because we think we might be prying, or it's private, or we don't really know what we're talking about, and they're soldiers and they wear uniforms and we don't, so we live in different worlds. We're not really so willing to engage in the hard conversation. Was it an unjust war and we shouldn't have had it? And the awful feelings of futility that many soldiers feel as they think about what's going on with ISIS in areas they thought they secured, in Tal Afar, Mosul, or Fallujah, etc. So there's a moral mess that comes home if you've got a thinking brain on you. And some of it you can't process because there's a lot of cognitive dissonance. Some of it you don't want to process, and you want to just medicate with booze, or medicate by driving fast on bases, or medicate by being angry and being prone to strike out and have altercations. But some of it requires actual thinking about the circumstances of war and what you saw and what you did in a safe place with a person you trust. And so the opposite of moral injury is moral recovery and moral repair. And some of those emotions, like guilt, can be relieved a bit by empathy and self-empathy. Some of them, shame, by a sense of people hoping in you and you hoping in yourself. Trust, a sense of betrayal that your leadership betrayed you or your country betrayed you, by restoring bonds of trust somehow. And that's civilian work as much as clinical work. Long answer. Sorry.
No, that's great. No, it's I love that. I'm curious if the military is doing anything proactively. I know they're working hard to get more clinicians for mental health and things like that, but are they doing anything else to, help soldiers prepare for after war and dealing with the moral complexities of it?
Well, there are both researchers and clinicians and lots of outreach groups that are beginning to recognize that moral injury has a slightly different face than clinically understood PTSD. So the Bible of clinicians for reporting for insurance purposes and for diagnosis, which is called the DSM, Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, we're now up to edition 5, has slightly changed the definition of PTSD so that it includes some factors that or experiences, mood experiences, I believe they call it, of guilt and shame and whatnot, recognizing that it's not just responses to fear. So that's one thing that in that Bible out there of diagnosis, there's a wider understanding of trauma and post-traumatic stress trauma. In addition, there are folks that are doing active research on this on a clinical basis through the VA and in trying to set up treatment protocols that would involve telling your story, but not in a sense of trying to decondition the fear, but trying to develop compassion for yourself with the buddy that you left behind, whose life you just couldn't save, or the child who was caught in a collateral incident. Would she hold you and condemn you in the very way that you condemn yourself? That kind of thing. So the conversation is expanding in clinical circles, I think, as well as in outreach groups that deal with families that who are at the core of helping a returning service member in retreats and the like. And I go around talking at various conferences. There are many conferences. It's a slowly growing awareness of the complexity of the issues.
Very good. Well, Nancy, before we go, where can people learn more about your work?
Well, After War is a kind of character-driven, service member-driven book, so I would recommend that. It's available at all places that sell books, including Amazon. And it's extremely readable. And when I say character-driven, it tells the stories of service members who've come home, many I've known for years, who are my students or that I've known. So that's one place. I have a website, nancysherman.com, that has lots of information about the kind of work I do and the kinds of interests I have. So those are two places.
All right. Well, fantastic. Well, Nancy Sherman, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Brett. Pleasure talking. Thanks.
My guest today was Nancy Sherman. She is the author of the book Stoic Warriors and After War, and you can find those both on Amazon.com. Go check them out. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the show, again, I'd really appreciate it if you'd give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Really help us out in getting the word out about the show and also help giving us feedback on ways we can improve it. I really appreciate your support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.